From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, major changes to Massachusetts driver's licenses.
Change is difficult, and we understand that the registry historically has not been an easy agency for our customers to be able to understand what they need to do to be successful.
Also today, Facebook says it's improving privacy protections, but will it do enough?
I want to know what they are going to do to make sure that consumers know what information is shared and that they be given the right to consent to it.
Plus, Russians hacked their way into critical U.S. infrastructure. What could happen next?
The thing that should concern all of us is if we have somehow worked ourselves into a situation whereby either side will start to use cyber attacks to shut down parts of our infrastructure.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Major changes are on the way to new Massachusetts driver's licenses. Beginning tonight, all Registry of Motor Vehicle services will be unavailable until Monday morning. That's because the state is upgrading its systems in order to roll out a new type of driver's license, one that is compliant with federal Real ID standards. Now, the old type, non-Real ID Massachusetts licenses will still be available, but beginning in October of 2020, those older style licenses will not get you on board a domestic airline flight or into federal buildings. So joining us now with more on what to expect and what's changing is Adam Vaccaro. He is transportation and infrastructure reporter for the Boston Globe. Adam, it's good to talk with you.
Meghna, hello. Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, I should say that we reached out multiple times to MassDOT and the Registry of Motor Vehicles, and they were unable to provide us with any official or spokesperson to sort of walk us through what the changes are. So, Adam, that means it's you who's going to do some of that explaining here. So, I mean, but you've done reporting on this. Tell us, what is changing with licenses in Massachusetts?
Yeah, no pressure there, huh, Meghna?
No, not at all.
So starting Monday, there will be new requirements if you're hoping to get an ID in Massachusetts. This is true for the real IDs, which are federally compliant, and those will be a little bit stricter than getting a Massachusetts license. But even getting a renewal of your Massachusetts license is going to require more documentation than it has in the past.
Okay, so specifically, what more documentation will people be needing?
If you want a real ID, you have to be prepared to bring a Social Security card or a document showing a Social Security number, so think maybe a W-2 form. You will need to bring proof of citizenship or lawful residence, so this could be a U.S. passport, a birth certificate, a green card, or several types of immigration documents. Finally, you're also going to need to bring two proofs of Massachusetts residency. This might be a bank statement or a utility bill. If you just want the Massachusetts license, the non-real ID, you're still going to need a single proof of lawful presence or citizenship, as well as one proof of Massachusetts residency. There's a lot of different documents, so I'm just going to throw this out quickly. mass.gov/ID has a handy checklist that will list them all.
Great. And so mass.gov/ID, and we'll put a link to that at radioboston.org as well. Now, Adam, I mean, this major change is happening because Massachusetts needs to come into compliance with a federal law, right? The Federal Real ID Act of 2005, from 13 years ago. So just remind us why that passed and why has it taken Massachusetts so long to get to this point?
Sure. Yeah, this was an idea that came out of the wake of the 9/11 attacks. Being able to verify the identity of people became something that was considered a potential security measure that the U.S. government wanted to take up. So they have been slowly, as you alluded to, rolling this out. There have been several delays, not just in Massachusetts, but across the country. But time is basically out. October 2020 seems to be the drop-dead date for Massachusetts and several other states. While many of the states have already taken this up, Massachusetts is going to be that's going to be the date for
Right. And again, October 2020, just to remind folks, because that's the day that the federal government has said that old-style IDs won't get you on board domestic airline flights or into federal buildings. And just to underscore it, I mean, this is a significant change, again, that, as you were saying, the federal government required back in 2005 because basically they wanted to get a minimum set of security standards built into all state-issued IDs across the 50 United States. And that's the major change here. And it seems as if Massachusetts is catching up now, 13 years later. It's going to take a lot of work on the part of the RMV. And a little earlier this week, Registrar Aaron Devaney did speak at a MassDOT meeting to talk about some of those efforts.
Change is difficult, and we understand that the registry historically has not been an easy agency for our customers to be able to understand what they need to do to be successful. Everything that we've been looking at with implementing this new system has been thinking about how can we help our customers in as easy and as successful a way as possible.
So, Adam, you've been reporting about this. I mean, what is the RMV doing in order to prepare for the possible influx of people come Monday who will be looking for a new ID?
So RMV locations are going to be closed effective tonight until Monday morning. So they're only losing one business day of being open. However, the entire software system on the back end is also going to be shut down, with the only exception being for law enforcement purposes. So if you're looking to get an inspection this weekend, if you're looking to renew a license online, that will not be an option. Effective Monday morning, this new software is going to be in place. This new software technically is not real ID software, but it is software that makes following the real ID rules easier. It's also going to be able to make some changes to what people see when they are on the RMV website that are unrelated, but should make things a little bit easier there.
Hmm. Well, Adam Vaccaro, transportation and infrastructure reporter for the Boston Globe. We've got links to his reporting about the Real ID changes in Massachusetts, plus resources that Adam talked about in order to know what kind of documentation you're going to need moving forward. We've got all of that at radioboston.org. Adam, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as you heard Adam say, there's a whole new list of pieces of documentation and identification you're going to need in order to get a new Massachusetts driver's license that's Real ID compliant. Some of that has immigration advocates concerned. So let's turn now to Ava Malona. She's executive director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, or MIRA. Ava, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, MIRA has raised some concerns in the past about Real ID. I mean, what are your concerns?
So let me first say that we have been expecting this for some time.
Yeah.
The legislature passed a bill to implement Real ID in July 2016, and advocates, we have worked with the RMV and DOT over the past several months to ensure that the new procedures take into account the needs of immigrants. And we're very grateful that they have been very transparent, worked very hard to ensure that people will know what their choices are and what is required to get a license. And it's important to stress that everybody who has a valid license or ID, including immigrants, can continue to use it until it expires. The new requirements apply to people who don't have a license or need to renew on or after March 26th.
I see.
So the key change that immigrants especially need to be aware of is that you can no longer get a license just with a Social Security number.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're getting a Real ID or a standard Massachusetts license, you'll now have to show proof of U.S. citizenship or lawful presence. And it's easier because if you're a citizen or have a green card, you can still go online, put in your information, all supporting documents, and get your license renewed for 5 years.
Mm.
The concern for us is for individuals who have a limited term visa,
right,
or temporary status, like the Haitians and the Salvadorians who are TPS, or the DACA recipients.
Right.
They need to go to the RMV in person, and they'll only get a limited term license. And this change is going to have a real impact on immigrants in Massachusetts, particularly those whose status is uncertain, people who apply for asylum or apply for adjustment of status, and those whose status has lapsed. So I mean, Mira has spoken.
May I just jump in here for a second, Eva?
Sure.
Because, I mean, to the point that you're making right now, I think there are many people at the federal level and even some here in Massachusetts who say this is exactly why Real ID needs to come online, because they feel that some immigrants with that uncertain status have used this big loophole of only needing a social security number in order to get a state-issued ID that allows them to stay in the country longer than perhaps they were legally entitled to.
Well, everyone who is issued a social security number has been eligible, and it's eligible to use that social security number. So, for instance, all TPS individuals who have a social security number and authorized to work are eligible now for a driver's license. But the fact that the status will lapse, and people who have uncertainty in terms of determination of their immigration status. For instance, you know, people who applied for adjustment of status. It's uncertain as to when they will be approved or show the documentation to the satisfaction of the agency. And that was one of the reasons that we fought very hard in 2016 to offer people an alternative to Real ID that did not require proof of lawful presence. Hmm. We didn't quite get there, but we remain hopeful that the legislature will revisit this issue. And we need to be realistic. In Massachusetts, you can't get around without a car.
Right.
For everyone's safety, all drivers, in our view, should be licensed and insured no matter what their immigration status is. 14 states, including Connecticut and Vermont, have recognized that offered licenses to all drivers,
right,
all residents,
well, you know,
without...
That's an interesting point and actually a somewhat contentious one. And I'd love to come have you back on the show later on to talk about that. But at this point in time, I'm afraid, Ava, we have to head into a break. So Ava Malona, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, we've got links to more information about Real ID and the changes coming to the Massachusetts RMV. That's all at RadioBoston.org. So check it out. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Call it the Mark Zuckerberg apology tour.
This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
That is the Facebook CEO last night on CNN, one of many media outlets Mark Zuckerberg spoke with yesterday. He was responding to the barrage of criticism against Facebook for its role in providing data to Cambridge Analytica, the British data firm with ties to Donald Trump's 2016 campaign that accessed information, again, Cambridge Analytica did this, from 50 million Facebook users without their knowledge. Well, now lawmakers are demanding that Zuckerberg testify before Congress. When CNN asked him if he would, here's what he said.
So the short answer is I'm happy to if it's the right thing to do. So what we try to do is send the person at Facebook who will have the most knowledge about what Congress is trying to learn. So if that's me, then I am happy to go.
Well, this morning on MSNBC, here's how Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal responded to that.
You are the right person. You should come before the committee. There's no question about it. We hope you do it voluntarily. If it is my decision, I would subpoena him today.
Well, joining us now with his thoughts on how Facebook is handling this moment and what the company really does need to do to protect your privacy, Jonathan Zittrain. He's professor of international law at Harvard Law School and faculty director at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Jonathan Zittrain, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Meghna.
So first of all, what do you make of Mark Zuckerberg's sort of tour of major media outlets yesterday and what he said regarding his apology to Facebook users?
Well, it certainly generates headlines, and he's saying some of the things that people would expect him to say. I guess if I had an opportunity to ask him a question, it would be, do you think something is fundamentally broken here, or is this, as often is said to be the case when something goes awry, in any endeavor, a bad apple kind of thing? Gosh, we trusted somebody. They turned out not to be trustworthy. We will be more suspicious in the future. Forensic audit. And I think he's probably at the moment intimating more in the second direction, i.e., there's nothing majorly wrong with the ecosystem. We just need to be less trusting. And over time, I don't know if that will result in the evolution of the space towards a more privacy protective in a fundamental way direction.
I mean, I think this is exactly the heart of the matter, right? Because what Zuckerberg posted on Facebook is that they're going to do what you said. Like, they're going to investigate all apps and conduct this full forensic audit to see if, you know, other sort of abuses of Facebook information has happened before. They're going to restrict developers' access to data. And they want to help users understand which apps they've allowed to access their data. So these are all very sort of technocratic fixes. But I think you're getting to the deeper point, which is, does Facebook recognize or believe even that, is there something fundamentally wrong with their entire business model? I mean, Jonathan Zittrain, are you saying that there is?
Well, I think the practice by which we release tons of information to one website, call it Facebook, both what we volunteer, you know, Google maybe has to infer from our searches what we're doing. With Facebook, it's like, sure, I'll tell you what I like. I'll click a like button next to all these things. And they see with whom we engage. There's all sorts of behavioral cues. That is information that seems not very sensitive one piece at a time, but, of course, adds up to a mosaic that, especially with, you know, some advances in machine learning and data processing, means you can infer an awful lot about somebody using all the information that they offer up. And the question is, to what end? Why are we compiling dossiers on ourselves that we share? And one reason might be, well, it allows news to be targeted to us in a satisfactory way, although we're still working on satisfactory, many of us there. But otherwise, it might be, you know, maybe we shouldn't have semi-public dossiers that apps are constantly importuning us to share pieces of in order to get access to a new website or service. You know, you use Facebook to sign up for something else. That kind of model, and we haven't really even talked about advertising yet, but that kind of model is one that tends to accrue data in one place, and that seems like not a great recipe for long-term privacy.
Right. I mean, so yesterday I was talking with Hiawatha Bray at The Globe, and he pointed out, just to underscore the obvious, that we're also talking about vast amounts, right, for 2 billion people, and that, you know, no single government has ever possessed that much information about folks. I'm curious what you think about Mark Zuckerberg when he was asked, should Facebook be regulated? He didn't outright say no, but he didn't say yes either. He said, I am not saying that I don't think it should be regulated. I mean, is that sort of a pathway towards a fix for this fundamental problem we're talking about?
Well, I wouldn't be cynical about that kind of answer. I think he, in the place he's in, has to be sort of non-committal but open to anything, and then figure out, well, what do you mean when you say regulation? It also may be that the kind of regulation that a bigger company might welcome would be one that would be much harder for smaller startups that also deal with personal data, just at a much smaller scale, to kind of wrap their arms around. So there's a kind of a trade-off even between privacy regulation and robust competition and kind of generative invention around the web. Over the longer term, surely a piece of this is going to be regulatory, but we need some really creative ideas. Mm-hmm. We are to have these big dossiers that get accumulated as to how to better protect their privacy. And there are some really neat, both, I think, legal/regulatory and technical approaches that together can lead to a different landscape than the one of 2015, which is roughly the one we have right now.
Yeah. So do you have an example?
Yeah. So on the legal front / policy front, Jack Balkin, a colleague of mine at Yale, has developed an idea around what he calls information fiduciaries. And the basic idea is when a client talks to a lawyer or a patient to a doctor, that lawyer or doctor is a very powerful person in the relationship. They have access to the levers of power there, whether it's a cure for a disease or whether or not you're going to go to jail. They owe certain duties both to the patient or client and to society at large as they exercise that power, including around how they'll handle sensitive information that their client or patient offers.
Right.
And there may be an analogy then to why shouldn't Facebook declare, or if not ready to declare, be told, you and others like you have certain responsibilities to your users as they entrust stuff that go beyond whatever you happen to have in your terms of service about what you will and won't do.
Jonathan, we just got about 30 seconds here more to go, but to your point there on these sort of creative solutions, what you just described seemed to me to, in order for to get there, it would require some kind of regulation and or legislation. Do you see the appetite for that in Washington?
Traditionally, there isn't much appetite in Washington, whether because of gridlock or because of a general solicitude to companies, but there are appetites elsewhere. Europe, for example, has competitive reasons and sensitive culture around privacy reasons to be more aggressive, and that may be enough to start a ball rolling, at which point America would say, well, if it's good enough for them, maybe it's good enough for us. So I wouldn't say that's not possible, and even the companies themselves, I think, are coming around to the idea that they have a public relations problem and they have a trust problem, which is why Mark is on the road right now. So they may even find it a decent idea to offer some common sense protections.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan Zittrain is a professor of international law at Harvard Law School and faculty director at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. Jonathan, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let's stick with the world of technology because there's lots of other big news there. Last week, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the FBI announced that Russian hackers targeted and penetrated some of the country's most sensitive infrastructure, including power, nuclear, water, and aviation networks. Now, that news got buried a little bit, in my opinion, because the government included this announcement with the more headline-grabbing news that the Treasury Department had slapped new sanctions on Russians for interfering in the 2016 presidential election. So let's get back to this cyber hack of critical infrastructure. Because put another way, DHS is saying that the Russians could have turned off the lights and possibly even the water for parts of the country, maybe even much of the country. But here's the thing. Joel Brenner wasn't surprised by that. He's former National Security Agency Inspector General, and he worked in the office of the Director of National Intelligence. And a year ago, March 2017, on this very show, he warned that something like a Russian hack on our infrastructure could happen.
We know that sophisticated attackers can take down the systems that power our electric grid, pipelines, railway switches, banks, and so on.
Which is why, in 2017, Brenner and MIT's Research Policy Initiative offered recommendations to the Trump administration on how to prevent such attacks. And Joel Brenner joins us once again in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me back.
So this is your chance to tell America, I told you so.
Well, I would put it differently. Let's just say that what's new here is that the public is being told from high levels of government that this is as serious as some of us have been saying for quite some time. Hmm. And it is very serious because our electric grid in particular, and frankly, lots of our critical infrastructure, by which I mean the kinds of systems that make the whole country work, not just electric power, but chemical plants, railroad transportation, all these things are penetrable. They're architecturally weak and easily penetrated, and we've known that for quite a while.
So I just want to talk for a second about how, according to DHS, the Russians exploited some of those architectural weaknesses that you're talking about. It looks like they sort of got into the various systems through not perhaps initially directly through, say, a grid operator, but through subcontractors using things like, I don't know, what was it, hacked Microsoft Word documents and things like that?
Lots and lots of penetrations of major networks come through the third parties they deal with, the vendors, the contractors. Let me give you an example. The Target breach some years ago, which shocked the public, was actually accomplished by importing malware through their heating, ventilation, and air conditioning subcontractor.
Wow.
So that the one looks for, if you're an attacker, you look for the easy place to find. What's the soft underbelly? And that's often not the actual target you're after, but somebody that they deal with on a regular basis and trust. And that's what the Russians have been doing.
So staging malware with those smaller commercial operators, subcontractors. This is from DHS. The Russians conducted spear phishing, gained remote access into energy sector networks, sometimes using systems where logins didn't require second party verification, right, through your phone, two-step verification, right. Things like that. But I guess we can talk about then what they did afterwards. But it does make me wonder what you're describing is sort of a low tech, loosely connected, not very well overseen system of companies and subcontractors, but who collectively are in charge of extraordinarily important infrastructure in this country.
Collectively, they are, and individually, some of them are. But even when you're looking at an individual company, not just a sector, you're talking about systems of systems. And those systems of systems are being used by individuals. And very often, the people are the weakest part of of that system. People click on stuff they shouldn't click on. My old friends at NSA used to say that the weakest link in any system was never the silicon-based unit on the desk. It was the
carbon-based
unit in the chair. That's right. And that's the case here with phishing attacks, for example. Some of these are not individual behavior issues. They're management issues. For instance, not using dual-factor authentication for sensitive systems. That's easy to do sometimes, but people have to understand that when they're doing something that important, yes, there's going to be 5 seconds of delay, and people have to tolerate that in order to achieve higher security.
Yeah. So I'm sort of working my way through the levels of cyber penetration here that DHS and the FBI says the Russians were able to achieve. That ultimately, the hackers collected information pertaining to industrial control systems. So, I mean, Joel Brenner, just not to put too fine a point on it, but is this the government saying that if the Russians had wanted to, they could have turned off the lights?
That's how I read it. I think that we are seeing what in military terms is called preparation of the battle space. In the old days, people talked about preparation of the battlefield. You pre-positioned tanks near the border. You moved ammunition up where you'd need it. You did some psychological operations in the territory you were going to attack, for example. Now they talk about the battle space because so much of it is electronic. And I think that what we saw here was the pre-positioning of tools that could be used to bring down a particular network.
But would Russia ever really go that far? Because I imagine if they did, I mean, maybe not. But there's the spy poisoning in the UK. But like if they did, if they decided to switch off the lights in New York City, wouldn't that be seen in the United States as tantamount to an act of war?
It might be. But here's what I want your listeners to understand. The existence of these vulnerabilities themselves conditions our exercise of national power. I'll give you an example. In 2014, when the bank J.P. Morgan was breached, initially it was thought that was a Russian attack. It wasn't. But that's what President Obama thought. And there was a piece in the New York Times in which Obama was quoted as asking his intelligence chiefs whether Putin was sending him the message, a message. That is, was Putin telling Obama, and this was when Ukraine was up in flames, not just smoldering, that if we, the United States, took more forceful action in Ukraine, that Putin was going to take down a major American bank? Now, that's something that the president would have to take into account when deciding how to exercise or whether to exercise our national power, including military power, so that the existence of fundamental vulnerabilities in civilian-controlled critical infrastructure does affect the White House's ability to pull the lever of international power. Because the game that's being played here now, Meghna, is not open warfare. Mm-hmm. The hostilities are taking place in the gray space between war and peace at the level that is carefully calibrated to be below the level of what the public calls acts of war, which would be an armed attack in the parlance of international law. So we're seeing things that are hostile, they are expensive, they do hamper us, they hobble us, but they're not things that are going to lead to open warfare. That's the space in which Putin is playing, and he plays his cards very well.
So the notion that the mere possibility of the Russians being able to do something like this, and that that might inform a U.S. national security response, is very sobering. But to be fair, the U.S. is playing in this same space too, right? I mean, wasn't it the United States and Israel that unleashed Stuxnet onto Iran and stopped all their centrifuges in Iran?
We should hope that the United States knows how to play very well in this space, and we should certainly hope that. I'm not going to confirm what's widely accepted. That it was the United States and Israel did that. The public information about it certainly looks that way. I can't speak to it directly because I was in office at the time.
Well, but how about the NSA's exploit that was originally the exploit that was originally identified by the NSA that ended up becoming the WannaCry virus when it was released to the public through a different?
This is a very important conversation about that you're opening, a subject you're opening, which is, what happens when a weapon, a cyber weapon, which might take maybe only a few foreign intelligence services could develop, once it's out there, it's like a cookbook recipe.
Yeah.
And it's a bunch of graduate students can do it. A bunch of undergraduate students can do it. That's happening right now. And I think that really raises the question of, wouldn't it be desirable if we had some international constraints on it? I have to tell you, though, that the likelihood of international agreements in this area with China and Russia, who are the two parties we'd like to come to agreement with, is not going to happen. We can't even reach agreement with them on the treatment of common ordinary cyber fraud and crime.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, however much one might like to see that, I think it's not in the cards anytime soon. If you equate an attempt to delay the Iranian nuclear program with an attempt to bring down civilian infrastructure, then I would have a disagreement with you about that. But there's no.
I'm not necessarily equating it. I'm just saying that we shouldn't be naive in thinking that the United States is probably not also trying to be as sort of forward thinking about this new cyber battle space as Russia is.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And all nations that can do it are doing it. This is an area in which we couldn't afford not to be capable. Yeah. But we are not exercising those capabilities at this point against civilian infrastructures elsewhere.
Well, so this gets us back to sort of what sort of defensive capabilities we ought to be thinking about here regarding our civilian infrastructure. Because I do note that there has been extensive reporting that Ukraine is the one I think of, that a couple of times in Ukraine in 2015 and 2016, it does seem as if Russian cyber offensive did knock out power in parts of Ukraine. So Ukraine has been something of a testing ground for the Russians. They've done it before. But I think there's something basic I want to explore with you here, Joel Brenner. I mean, when we talk about power, for example, or any one of these utilities, most of it is not owned by the federal government, right? I mean, these are private sector businesses that may be heavily regulated, but we're leaving a lot of the protections, the defensive protections, up to them, aren't we?
Oh, you're so right. The most frequent number I see is that something on the order of 85% of what we classify as critical infrastructure is privately owned. And in the United States, the government cannot simply issue orders as to how people ought to run their businesses, and we don't want them to do that. So the question is, how do we move that sector or group of sectors toward a more secure posture? The electric grid is, for the most part, regulated at the state level. The federal government regulates interstate transmission, but not the generation and delivery of electricity.
Right.
So that we really are talking about how could the federal government play a more active, much more robust convening role with public utility commissioners at the state and territorial level. I would like to see that. I don't see it happening now. And then the question is, well, what would you want to tell those people?
Okay, well, just to that point, we do have a little bit of tape here. This is from last week, from March 14th. Energy Secretary Rick Perry was testifying about the Trump administration's $1.5 trillion infrastructure proposal, which includes some cyber.
DOE is in the process of establishing a new Office of Cybersecurity, Energy Security, Emergency Response, acronym is CSER. To enhance the resilience of our energy assets and better protect them from this growing cyber threat that is out there.
Okay, so that's Secretary Perry saying a new Office of Cybersecurity. But Joel Brenner, last year you told us very clearly that there are multiple recommendations that you forwarded to the Trump administration, one of which was that we have to take critical infrastructure off the public internet. Just like build, I was going to say build a wall, but at least build a moat between it.
I think that isolation of critical controls, limited number of critical controls in critical infrastructure, isolating them from the public internet is absolutely essential if we're going to become materially more secure. Now, isolation is a relative term, and rational people can disagree about exactly how to implement that kind of notion. We do see it in some places. For example, in pipeline controls now, we see companies that have analog controls on pipeline pressure so that if the online electronic digital controls were to go haywire and intentionally run up the pressure in a line so that it would explode, you'd have an analog control that would override that. That's an example of an isolated control. You could not find that analog device on the network because it's not there. And if you can't find it, you can't attack it. Well, that's just one limited example. But by and large, you know, we've actually, in some of these cases, we've had controls that were accessible through Bluetooth, so the guy in the truck didn't have to get out of a truck on a rainy day to check the device.
That's half expecting you saying like a kid with his Xbox could hack the grid.
I've given an extreme example, but ultimately, unless we're willing to pay some money and incur some inconvenience to isolate certain parts of our controls from the public internet, then we cannot become materially more safe.
Now, you did send this report to the Trump administration last year that outlined pages of recommendations at all levels. I mean, did you get any response from the administration?
We know that it was read and favorably reviewed,
okay,
and that as a result, the final order that came out had a lot more to say about critical infrastructure than the previously public drafts that had been circulated. And perhaps we had some influence on that. It's not for me to say. But we were glad to see this new emphasis in the president's executive order. That was, for people who follow these things, 13,800 last spring. But what we haven't seen yet is evidence of much follow-up.
Yeah.
And it's been a year. Or nearly a year, and 10 months or so. And there have been quite a few cabinet-level commissions, so on, or reporting groups, but we haven't heard from them. And I don't know what they're going to say.
Well, Joel Brenner, we've just got 1 minute to go here. I want to get back to the most chilling thing that you said earlier, that sometimes just the knowledge that a foreign government, in this case Vladimir Putin, could do something like, you know, turn off the lights, is enough to change America's national or have enough impact on America's national security response. I mean, I can't step away from that. With the knowledge that they did actually get as close to industrial control systems in this country, I mean, is it already too late?
No, but it is already very serious. And you have picked out the single most important thing I want your listeners to understand. There are some forms of power that are more effective before they are exercised than after they're exercised. Because after they're exercised, one you know, you take response measures. You are at war. You are dealing with this. Right now, it's the mere existence of this possibility that does control, that could condition our response to Russian future provocations in Ukraine, in the Baltics, and elsewhere.
Well, Joel Brenner is the former Inspector General of the NSA and head of U.S. counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. He's a senior research fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies. We'll have a link to the report that he forwarded to the Trump administration. We'll put that at radioboston.org. Joel Brenner, thank you so much.
A great pleasure. Thanks.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There is a lot going on in the world of art, so let's check in with WBUR art supporter Maria Garcia. She's with The Artery. That's our arts and culture unit. Maria, it's good to see you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Maria, first of all, let's start off with something that brings together the world of art and the law, because there's a case here in Massachusetts that could set some precedents for other places around the country. Earlier this week, the Supreme Judicial Court heard a single justice hearing where Justice David Lowy heard arguments in the case of the Berkshire Museum. So explain to us what's going on here.
This has been going on since last year, Meghna. The museum says it needs to sell 40 pieces of art, basically to stay afloat. They say they have no other choice. They either sell the art or they close. But critics say that the art was donated for the public good, meant for public view, and that the sale dishonors that intent, since the art would end up most likely in private collections.
I see. Now, and of course, also one of those pieces includes a Norman Rockwell painting that he personally donated to the museum. So this seems like it's a really big deal.
It's a really big deal, Meghna. I mean, the art world is watching Massachusetts in this case. And the thing is, Meghna, that selling artwork either to fund capital improvements or to balance budgets, it's just not something that cultural institutions do. It's pretty frowned upon. It happens very, very rarely. And the main reason is public trust. And so the concern is that these masterpieces will end up sold to the highest bidder, which will most likely be a private collector. So the art will hang in the private homes of wealthy people around the world instead of on view at public institutions. Mm. So here's Nicholas O'Donnell, an attorney representing residents opposed to the sale, who filed a brief as a friend of the court.
It is awful for me to contemplate that Massachusetts might be the place that sets the example that this sort of thing is okay. The temptation, I think, will be too much to bear for museums that have financial challenges, which many museums do.
Hmm. Interesting. But Maria, I mean, is it possible for people who are donating or even the museum itself to put a condition that the artwork can only be sold to other public institutions?
It's definitely possible. And here's where it gets tricky, Meghna. So the attorney general had originally sided with the opponents of the sale. But after a 7-month investigation, the AG is basically switching sides. It's siding now with the museum, saying, okay, yes, there are restrictions to these artworks, but the museum's finances are just too dire to consider them.
This is so interesting, because usually when museums are under some sort of financial stress, they may resort to a capital campaign or something like that. But how dire are the finances for the Berkshire Museum that it wants to take this kind of drastic step?
It's been operating under a $1.2 million annual structural deficit. And in court this week, the museum attorneys made this really impassioned argument to the court justice saying, look, many of the residents in Pittsfield live below the poverty line. The Berkshire Museum is their window to the world. The question here is, should this museum stay open or not? And the museum says they're sure that the only way for it to stay open is to sell the artwork.
Maria, this is such a fascinating case, right? Because at the core here, as you've been describing, there's this question of stewardship, right? People opposed to the sale say that the museum would be failing in its stewardship of making these wonderful masterpieces available for public view, mm-hmm. right? That they are stewards of that artwork. But their view of stewardship is keeping the museum open. But I just want to take a step back here. I mean, 40 pieces of art, how much money are we talking about?
a lot of money. Estimates are that the sale of the artwork, which include two paintings by Norman Rockwell, will net at least $55 million, Meghna.
Wow, wow.
So it'll be interesting to see what the court decides. The decision could come as soon as next month.
As soon as next month. Okay, so we'll be keeping our eye on that. Really interesting case. Maria, let's move on to another big story that has to do with art institutions. This is the firing of Helen Molesworth from the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. Now, before moving to L.A., Molesworth was chief curator at Boston's ICA. That was until 2014. And I talked to her a bunch of times on the show here, and I thought she was one of the smartest, most exciting curators I'd ever met. So what happened out in L.A.?
Yeah, a lot of people would agree with you. I mean, she's in curating world. I think she's considered a superstar. There's a lot of mystery to what happened. You know, MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art in L.A., has only said it parted ways with Molesworth because of creative differences, whatever that means.
Right.
But look, anyone who's followed her career knows she's an agent of change in the art world. She was very open about curating shows with women artists, artists of color. And even when she was in Boston, she was always trying to elevate the work of artists of color, though according to her, she did it in a bit of a sneaky way. Here she is in 2014 at the Hammer Museum in L.A. talking about her curating strategy.
At the ICA Boston, I realized that if I made certain arguments very explicitly about identity, that I would not be successful. And so I never made a stink about how I had systematically committed to shows by African-American women in the galleries.
This is where I'm confused about what happened in L.A. because, I mean, haven't museums in recent times been very vocal about championing exactly these sort of diverse kinds of shows and artists?
They have been vocal, Meghna, but that's different than actually doing the work, right? There's limited space in art museums. So if you want to highlight the work of people of color or people who have been historically left out of these spaces, sometimes you're going to have to leave out some artwork from those who have had access. And at MoCA, before her firing, Molesworth had been pretty vocal about being pressured by a white, wealthy male board to feature white male artists.
Okay, so this is interesting because Helen Molesworth's firing coincides with another woman doing sort of similar work, Laura Rykovich at the Queens Museum in New York, and she has been let go from there too?
Well, she left.
She left, okay.
She left, but she says that she left because the museum didn't support her vision. So Laura Rykovich, you know, she was a very outspoken director at the Queens. And earlier this year, she stepped down after pressure from the board. Rykovich was doing some really overtly political work, Meghna. She closed the museum during President Trump's inauguration. But what really caused her firing, according to a report from the museum, was that she, quote, improperly opposed hosting an event celebrating the founding of Israel, and that she didn't make it clear to the board that she was part of what they call a politically divisive book that supported the boycott of Israel.
Okay, so here we have two high-profile, you know, risk-taking female curators doing this daring work, and it seems as if, you know, whether people agree with it or not, that they have been pushed out of the art world, at least out of these two institutions, in just the span of a couple of months.
Yes, and I think people are still trying to figure out what that means, right? What does it say about the arts when these two women, who were essentially doing what the arts institutions say they want to do, putting on these thought-provoking shows, focusing on access to artists of color instead of white, established artists, and then just pushing the envelope? What does it say when these women were let go? And at the very least, I think, Meghna, it's an issue of really bad optics.
Mm. Well, one more story, Maria, before we go. And this one is about something near and dear to my heart or my head, curly hair. Because you reported a story about it this morning on Morning Edition about how curly hair can be an identifier of non-assimilation for many Latino women, right?
Yeah, that's right, Meghna. You know, the story is really about how our hair isn't just about us. It's also about how it makes others around us feel and how we're aware of that. You know, hair isn't just something that grows out of our head and has no meaning. It serves as an identifier, a way the world reads you. And in a world filled with biases, I think Latinas often change their curly hair to make themselves more approachable. and more legible.
Mm. Well, let me ask you something, because in your story this morning, Marie, you actually made a specific point to say that you're not Afro-Latina. And I'm just wondering why you felt it was important to make that distinction.
Because I think that there are degrees of severity to the politics of hair. You know, even as a young child, I sort of intuitively understood that certain hairstyles were symbols of class, and that my curly hair marked me as more ethnic, less assimilated. But, you know, Magna, I never feared getting expelled from school because of my hair, mm-hmm. like some black mm-hmm. girls have. And though all women of color, to a certain degree, have to contend with deviating from conventional Eurocentric beauty standards in the West, we know black women are overtly discriminated for their hair and that there's a history of even legislating black women's hair.
Hmm. Well, Maria Garcia is a reporter for WBUR's The Artery, and we've got links to all of Maria's story, including the one on curly hair, at radioboston.org. Maria, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.